He Joey grew up in Billings, and of course I grew up in Montana, east of Billings.
East of Billings, yeah.
So we never were.
So you weren't in this part of the country, yeah.
Not at that time.
Yeah.
So what we know about this part of the country, I think, is what other people told us. Bradley knows a lot about what happened to rural. Is it a rural city?
Yeah, right. It is. It's going to be a town. I'm going to create a town a little larger than DePuyer and put it on DePuyer's site. But the family will be probably a forest ranger in his family, and they'll have been around the state. They'll have relatives elsewhere. So pretty much the condition of Montana during the 30s and even back into the 20s when things weren't all that great in a lot of respects, too. Any of that probably would be helpful.
Well, Bradley, his family, I think, really had it tough during the Depression because they were down in the eastern part of the state where the drought struck so bad.
Mm-hmm. Were you farming down there, Brian?
Well, my dad had a small place, and he had a little bunch of cattle. And, and he farmed just a little bit, you know, just for feed.
Yeah.
Solid,
yeah. Where was it?
He wasn't any big. Around that Custer area, Montana.
The battlefield area?
Town of Custer.
The town of Custer, yeah.
It's not far from where the mouth of the Bighorn empties into the Yellowstone.
Mm-hmm.
And I was born on my mother's homestead north of Pompey's Pillar, out of the Bull Mountains. And then, my dad was around different places. He finally bought this section of ground that went out into the valley a little bit, but we didn't have irrigation in Peace Bottom. Now that's below the mouth of Bighorn on the opposite side, on the north side of the Yellowstone.
Peace Bottom?
Peace Bottom.
Okay.
Is it P-E-A-S-E?
That was an admiral fort there.
Huh.
Fort Pease. And, that was a. I knew some of those people that were the first settlers in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what were they trying to farm down there? What were they trying to do?
Oh, just like most people in those days, they just, raise a few livestock, and this is about all it was amounted to.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there were a lot of big outfits in there.
Yeah.
At the time. I was.
Would they try a little grain down there? Or?
Not too much. When I grew up there in that area, that would be long in the 30s. I was a teenager then. The valleys were fenced, and they had irrigation, and they had these beets. They raised sugar beets.
Mm-hmm.
But when you got out of the valley, it was all open range country. There was no fences. It was all public land, I guess, at the time. Mm-hmm. And there were a few ranchers at Hill Key locations, you know.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until about in the late 30s that they started forming those grazing districts.
Okay.
And they made these big grazing districts. But my father, he had less than 100 head of cattle, around 60 head probably. Put up a little hay there and raised a little grain up on top of the flat there. He just turned them out in the spring of the year, and they just went all over the country, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of horses then, too. That Chapel Brothers at that time, they had around 30,000 head of horses between Miles City and Custer, north of the Yellowstone.
Really?
You know.
Huh.
They had big canning factories back east, and then the market was Europe.
Where people were eat horse meat knowingly.
Well, the people there eat horse meat too. Those people that handled horses, worked horses.
They're perfectly.
They had no other source, so they would.
Yeah. Did you ever try it?
No, I never could eat a piece of horse meat. I had opportunities, but I never would.
Knowingly, maybe. When we were running sheep up here on the reservation, you know, we wouldn't touch mutton either. I think it's probably the same principle on lesser scales. So. Running cattle during the Depression was a losing proposition at best, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, you know, what happened then in the 30s, we had good years into the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Starting in about 33, it started to run, you know, a little short. And then 34 was worse. The grass never even greened up that spring. And then these hordes of grasshoppers. And so the government bought the cattle from the there's no place to go, and no one had any money to ship them anywhere.
Yeah, that was 34.
34, yeah. And I still have the sheet of paper, the settlement sheet. I run onto that here last winter in some of my mother's papers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to trail those cattle into Myers. It was about 10 miles.
Is that a shipping?
Shipping.
Yeah.
And they had anything that they didn't think would make the trip. They'd drive it over there and they'd shoot it and throw it in a pit, you know.
The government, who were you dealing with there? Would that be the county agents, or do you remember?
I just don't remember who.
But there'd be government men of some kind.
It was federal, wasn't it?
Federal
program.
The New Deal,
New Deal
program.
I talked to my uncle in Minnesota, and he said what they did, they shipped those cattle back in Minnesota. And they just, anyone wanted cattle could get them, and a lot of they didn't have enough room to place a lot of them, so they just turned them loose up there in northern Minnesota.
I know.
So there's people out there and just shot them like they were deer or butchers. So that's how the
funny way to run a country.
You know, the country was a lot more open than it is now. You couldn't do that now.
Right, yeah. Did they buy all your cattle?
Mm-hmm. So they were darn well. There wasn't any feed.
Yeah.
No hay.
Mm-hmm.
And it just wasn't anything to eat for them.
Yeah. You had about 100 head?
Oh, no. I'm around 60 head I guess, at the time. Maybe less than that, I guess, probably so.
Do you remember what you got for them offhand?
Oh, let's see. About $20 was the... Uh-huh. For growing mature animals, about that.
Yeah. What'd the family do then when you were rid of the cattle?
Of course, at those times, we lived off the land, too, and everyone canned their own winter supply of vegetables and that.
Yeah. There is a hell of a garden.
And I used to go out. They had millions of those sage hens in those days.
Oh, yeah.
And I used to just go out and anytime I wanted some fresh poultry or anything, I'd go shoot a couple sage hens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we always had our own meat, and my mother would can up a lot of it, and canned chicken, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, in the wintertime, you could probably some beef or that, and as long as it's freezing cold, you could keep it fresh.
Yeah.
But for the summer, they would can it. And it was just a barter system. There wasn't any money. You would trade something to the grocer for a few, like coffee and sugar and salt. Then we used to take a little wheat over to Hardin. There was a mill there, and you'd get flour ground.
Mm-hmm.
Take your own wheat over there and get flour. And neighbors would trade by. They run out of flour.
Yeah.
Well, you'd get them a sack of flour, and then when they had one, they'd return it.
What'd you do, pay the miller off in some of the...
I suppose, there wasn't. Yeah, I think that's how my dad did it,
because
it wasn't okay. Yeah. Of course, I mean, my dad, he repossessed his, he had a truck. Of course, they couldn't finish paying for that. Of course, they repossessed that. We were afoot there for a while, and he finally bought an old Model T for $5. You find that a little $5.
Literally $5?
Hell yeah, that was a going price for Model T. It was $5.
There must have been a lot of those Model Ts around these grasshopper poisoners are making contraptions out of Model Ts right and left. They send me pictures of all these things.
Yeah, I can remember poisonous grasshoppers, too. Yeah. They got the government furnishes. I remember they would furnish the... They used bran.
Yeah.
And then you'd do the mixing. Mm-hmm. The fellow who did it. They'd give you all the materials, mm-hmm. and then you'd drive along and throw it out of the wagon and just throw it out and along there and grass up. They either smell good enough to eat. They put a lot of molasses or something.
Yeah, and the guys up north said they sometimes used what they called banana oil.
Yeah, that was what it was. Banana oil.
Somebody told me that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's so potent.
I still don't really know what it is, except for the name of it, but amyl acetate, they told me it was, I guess. And anyway, it's apparently quite an attraction of grasshoppers, yeah. What are your memories of the grasshoppers? I guess they just came in clouds.
Yeah,
or
in
they...
34 and 35.
Yeah.
1935, that was a great sagebrush country, a lot of sage.
Mm.
And between what horses were left and those daggone grasshoppers, they just stubs sticking out of the ground.
Of the sage.
Of the sage.
Jeez.
Oh, yeah, I tell you. Huh. It's a miserable looking country.
Yeah. Well, those horse herds were cleaning hell out of things,
well,
too.
Well, yeah, they had to move out, the Chapel brothers. Yeah, they rounded up all their horses. And they shipped, a lot of their stallions, and they sent them to South America. And as I understood that, there was a story that they were going to set up operation in South America.
Huh.
And that was the last of the big horse herd. Yeah, I can remember riding up on a little butte there. There's a lot of buttes in those kind of country. Mm-hmm. And I rode up there on a butte one day. I looked around the base. I counted seven bands of horses around that band.
Yeah.
And we used to have a problem if you, especially had a saddle bearer, if you turned a saddle bearer out on the open range there, run out of short grass, and I had that happen to me, and it, one of those studs would pick her up, And I located her one day, and I tried to get her away from that stud, and I couldn't do it, couldn't get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go get help, and finally got her out.
Yeah, well, between grasshoppers and wild horses.
Wild horses.
Yeah, oh, I loved it. I thought that was a great life.
Were you able to work at that time as a teenage kid? Could you get a job?
One summer there, and my dad and I, he got a job helping an old bachelor down there, had an irrigated ground to hay,
mm-hmm.
about 4 or 5 miles from our place. Old John Dolly. So my dad, he stayed there, and I'd ride my horse, saddle horse, back and forth morning and night, see, and then I'd mow or rake or do something like that during the day, and then the evening I'd ride home and do the chores, see. Other than that, I had to ride back about 10 miles a day, I guess.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Of course, I love... I always figured I was going to make my living just like the other cowboys, on a horse. So I was just like riding a bike or a bike today.
Yeah, right. So you thought it was a great life in spite of all.
Oh yeah, I thought it was. But I do remember there was times, like when I was in high school. I remember one. I forget what year. I must have been a junior. I graduated in 35.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember there was a show there. I went to school in high. That was 17 miles from high school. And they had a bus. They operated a bus. And I wanted to go to that show, and there wasn't any money in the house at all. I had some Indian head pennies I'd been saving, and I had enough of those to go to that show. But I studied that for about quite a bit, and I said, no, I don't think I'll do that.
I think Indian head pennies are in the safe deposit box of the
stockman's
bank. They're still hanging out.
I finally gave them to our son. He still got them.
Yeah. That's looking at life pretty closely.
You had to make those tough judgments.
You have to weigh something like that. So. Yeah.
But, Now the people who had irrigated farms there, and they weren't large at that time, that raised sugar beets, they got along pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they had a cash crop.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't much, but heck, they could buy a new car once in a while, and they'd buy a new truck to haul the beets.
Yeah, a little looking around, I've done in the agricultural history of the time, over in the Flathead area too, there's kind of a boom in sugar beets during the 30s. And people, yeah.
There was a lot of beets, you know, that from around Billings east to Miles City, that was all sugar beets in the Bighorn Valley too.
Yeah.
But it was just, you know, those unirrigated areas, and the people were, if you were in the livestock business, like, it really got tough.
Well, when you were working, helping that guy hay, what were you doing? Running the rake or something?
Oh,
or how did you put up hay over there, too?
Well, it was all horses, you know, horse mower and overshot
Overshot stacker, okay. That's what I wondered. I was always around an overshot stacker in that white sulfur country, and God, I get up here and everybody's using beaver slides, which I never even saw work.
Yeah.
You know, so.
I never did work around those either.
Do you remember... if power buck rakes were operating in the 30s, or are they later? You think they were? Okay.
They were in western Montana. I never did see one down eastern Montana.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But in, see, when, in 36, January 36, my dad, that was after he'd lost his place there, he had an offer. He, the man came down visiting there that summer, and he tried to talk my dad into going up in Galton Valley. This fella had taken over a big corporation type ranch there in the around that Manhattan. And he talked my dad into coming up and running one of them. I had three different ranches. So January 36, we loaded everything we had in the truck and we went up to. I think after my dad's sale, he sold everything he had, and as I remember, we had this old truck and all our household goods and $150. So that's what I had.
Leaving the country, that would have been good, huh?
Yeah. Things are getting tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I found one of those old sail things, Ivan.
Oh, yeah?
I decoupaged it on a piece of old wood. I thought you might be interested in looking.
Would this be from...
That was his sale.
December 6, 1935.
Yeah. I have to copy down some of this stuff here.
It wasn't a lot to sell, but...
Wasn't anything of great wealth, just a bunch of stuff, you know. But he did get a few dollars out of it.
Yeah. Were you ever around any of that... I don't forget down in that country, the... been reading about the Plentywood area, you know, where they got some kind of radical politics, and hell, anybody would show up for a sale and bid four bits on it, and nobody would bid any higher.
Oh.
And they'd give the stuff back to the guy. They were pretty well organized up there in a kind of a socialist league, I guess.
I see. Yeah.
And North Dakota, there was quite a bit of that. Would come over the border into a...
Oh, they protected each other.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there'd be guys around the edge with axe handles or something to suggest that other people didn't bid.
Well, it's too bad they weren't organized.
No,
anymore.
I didn't have seen
never
it.
Came
not
across
in
that.
Not in that area.
That corner of the state's the only place I can find anything about that. Back to buck rakes, though. You're pretty sure you saw power buck rakes operating in the 30s.
Once you got
in Gallatin.
There in the lower Madison, they had them.
Mm-hmm.
My dad had the first. We then got on a ranch there in the lower Madison. That's above Three Forks.
Yeah.
After a couple of years there for this corporation, my dad leased a ranch there, two ranches on the lower Madison. And he bought one of those farm hold tractors with a mower and a buck rake away with it and a plow. And it was the first power mower in that valley. And that was in 1938 that he bought that. But they did have power buck rakes. They'd taken old cars and turned them around, you know.
Yeah.
And they were using them in the big hole at that time. But what they would do in the big hole, they would buy buy the chassis from the factory.
Is that right?
Yeah. Buy new truck chassis.
Huh.
And then they in their own shops. They
yeah.
Do that.
Yeah. I'll be there. Did you ever hang over there?
No, I never did. Yeah. I've talked to a lot of people.
Yeah. My dad hayed over there one summer, and I've always wished that I'd gotten all that material from him, but never was bright enough to do that.
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of people who had hay in that area, but they still were using horse mowers, but they were using power buck rakes. I never could, but they finally, about that time that my dad, probably in the late 30s, they started converting over to power mowers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. What was it like in Billings during some of this?
Well, at our house it was kind of crowded.
Is that right?
Well, okay. Yeah, we didn't have a large family. There was just my brother and myself. But my dad was one of the people who kept his job. He took a 10% pay cut, but he worked for the gas company in Billings. He was a repairman and meter reader, so he was able to keep his job.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they raised a big garden. You know, we rented some land out on the Billings bench.
Uh-huh.
And my mother and dad would garden. And we would have done all right, I think, but my mother had a very big family in Missouri, and whole families would descend upon us for months at a time.
Is that right? Various relatives?
Didn't have any place to go, and come to Montana and think maybe they were going to find some work in Montana.
They were aiming specifically for Montana. They weren't passing through to anywhere in particular usually, huh?
Well, they usually stayed a while.
Yeah.
It seemed to me they stayed a long time.
Did they go back then to Missouri?
Yeah.
They went back to Missouri.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And my mother had a lot of nephews and nieces, you know, that would come out here looking for work, and they'd stay with us for a while, and they wouldn't find any work. They'd finally go back home to Missouri.
So you really had kind of the grapes of wrath migration going through your house.
You know, it affected everyone.
Yeah.
I think.
Uh-huh.
And
I imagine that you're trying to grow up in that, and there are perennial people passing through, and that's...
Yeah, you got displaced from your bedroom quite a bit.
Right.
Well, and my father, I think, was working for about $110 a month, you know, and living in town. And, you know, it wasn't, he was quite a patient man, I think. When I look back on it, I think, my Lord, he was good to let those people move in.
Yeah. I suppose your family did a lot of gardening and canning and trying to help out with the...
Yeah, they did. Now, my father bought a little, what they call a 5-acre tract out of Billings in the 30s. I graduated from high school in 1939, so I can remember your date pretty well, you know. But we were out there, I think, about 3 years at the time I was going to high school. And it seems to me by that time people had kind of settled down and decided they'd just stay where they were during the Depression.
Uh-huh. You know,
there wasn't all this migration that there was in the early 30s.
Yeah, okay.
So we had a garden, and they irrigated. Brad and I were back there this weekend in Billings. We couldn't even find where I had lived. It has changed so.
Is that right?
Couldn't find one thing.
Uh-huh.
Not what, one thing. The house is gone.
What part of town was it down there?
We were off what we call Cemetery Road then, which was out in the country, and we were well below the cemetery. Now the town is built way beyond the cemetery. The cemetery is right in the middle of town.
Uh-huh.
Right in the, you know.
So they just kind of overran where you...
Yeah, so it is, they put a lot of industrial things out there, and there's there's a housing district out there, you know, but mm-hmm. I couldn't find the exact location. There just was nothing.
Hmm. You know, you can know the general area, but there's nothing yeah. there.
Yeah, right. You know, I couldn't
that
say.
That you could recognize it.
Yeah.
Couldn't say that's where our house was, because mm-hmm. I just couldn't recognize one
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
There had been a greenhouse out there where I turned into our lane, and then about a block up there had been a dairy farm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of those local
yeah.
ones that they don't have anymore.
Yeah, right.
And all of those buildings were gone.
Huh.
They were pretty big buildings, too.
Yeah.
You know, big barns,
yeah.
big house.
Did you go to Billings High School?
I was in the last graduating class out of the really old Billings High School.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then they built the first new one, and now there's a second one.
Right, yeah.
But ours was the last graduating class out of that.
Can you remember anything about being in high school during the Depression? I read some of the small towns, they wouldn't have an annual, or wouldn't be able to buy a class ring or something. It'd be some of the ways I remember Depression.
Well, I didn't buy a class ring.
Uh-huh.
I did buy an annual. Uh-huh. We did have an annual. I think the schools were still supported pretty well
mm-hmm.
in Billings.
Yeah,
in
big
fact,
enough price.
In fact, I think, you know, I think I got a pretty good education in Billings.
Yeah.
You did mention that, you know, the war was coming, and
mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, even as teenagers, we were well aware of that in my senior year,
mm-hmm.
that this war was hovering over this graduation class, and
mm-hmm.
you knew darn good and well those boys were going to war, and of course they all did.
Yeah, yeah. I was kind of dumbfounded looking through the issues of the Tribune for that summer, how many
yeah.
war headlines there were. It was
yeah.
kind of constant in there all during that summer and the year before. So right.
I went on. I'll have to tell you. I worked that summer after I graduated. You could not get a job. You couldn't get a job as a soda clerk or anything. There just were no jobs. So I worked as an apprentice in the Billings Library.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked for nothing all summer, 6 days a week, 8 hours a day. And then the person who did the best job got a $60 a month job. That's
wow.
what we were working for.
Uh-huh.
I didn't get the job.
Talk about competition, huh?
Yeah, it was pretty.
Yeah.
Well, it really was exploitation,
mm-hmm.
I think. You know, gosh, when you
yeah.
think of they're doing things like that to kids.
Yeah.
But,
what kind of household? How was your household set up in terms of divvying out chores or whatever when you were a kid, a teenage girl, and all these relatives would descend? Did you have to do dishes for all these people, or do you remember how things were sorted out?
Well, I don't know. My mother was a hard worker, so
mm-hmm.
you know, I think she took the main part of the
mm-hmm.
responsibility.
She's able to bear up under all
yeah,
this.
Yeah, I certainly helped, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But when people were around and there was a lot of cooking to do and so forth, why, she surely ramrodded the project.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that my parents even then thought my main job was school.
Yeah, yeah.
And to get an education.
Let me ask you this, because there's so damn many of them ended up out here. Do Missourians eat differently than Montanans? Were there favorite things they like that you can think of?
Great cooks.
They eat and eat.
I see, they eat a lot, huh?
Yeah, we
yeah.
used to have family reunions at Big Timber.
Uh-huh.
Because part of Mother's sisters lived in Billings and part of them lived in Bozeman, and that was an in-between
yeah.
point. So
uh-huh.
so we would travel to Big Timber and we'd meet down there. There was a park by the river and we'd
mm-hmm.
That's all we did was eat.
yeah.
Yeah, they Missourians eat a lot of fried chicken.
Uh-huh, okay. Okay.
And I was laughing, telling Bradley, I can remember one time we were driving to Big Timber, and my Uncle Plez was in the car ahead of us, and he ran into there was a road grader working on the road, even though I'm sure this was a Sunday, but he hit the back of a road grader, and we could see this car going over in the barrel pit, you know. And my mother said, "Oh my God, I hope Ruby didn't drop the succotash." So succotash was one
succotash
thing we did.
Pretty highly prized. Huh? Okay.
Yeah, they were. Yeah. They Missourians are a different breed.
Well, they are indeed. They're. Down in the white sulfur country, my dad and Missourians are kid back and forth that the only two nationalities tough enough to survive down there were Scotchmen and Missourians. And there were some up in the Dupuyer country, too. They came in, a lot of them came in to work teams, it seems, in the dam building and the railroad building and so forth. They were, ended
yeah,
up
Yeah, I suppose they were used to mules, too.
Yeah, I suppose. I find a record of some of them building the streets in Lewistown with teams too. So they were quite a bunch, all right. Quite a bunch of them.
Yeah, my mother came from a family of 10 sisters and 2 brothers. And I think about 6 of the sisters ended up in Montana. Yeah. One would come, and then another would come and visit and get married. I think is the way it happened.
Well, these people pull into your place and. Classic style of everything they owned on their cars and all of them in there too, or were they a little more prosperous than that?
Well, no, they weren't very prosperous, at least during the Depression.
Right.
I think that when my Aunt Toots and her family came, and my memory is that they stayed with us almost one whole winter because.
Mm-hmm.
Uncle Vern was out of a job, and I think they came in a car and with their clothes, and probably that's all there was. You know, they were pretty mobile. I don't think they didn't leave a house or a lot of belongings, and just didn't have very much.
Yeah, I remember when I was a school kid down there in Custer during those 30s, that Depression, in the summertime, those freight trains. I've counted as high as 150 men on the train.
Is that right?
And then going west. Then there'd be another one going east, about the same number. And those, they'd take on coal there at Custer. And those fellows would pile off that, and there's beet field there, and they'd go out and dig up a beach, you know, to get something to eat.
Uh-huh. My God.
Yeah, it was tough.
Huh. That's a detail I never heard of. Particularly the guys going both ways.
Yeah, they're just going both ways.
Just
going in every direction that train. They were just traveling, you know, looking for something.
Yeah.
Nothing to have.
Fairly tough-looking characters, I suppose. When
they were just ordinary people. They weren't bums. They were just people out of work looking for a job, and that was the only means of transportation.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was a train, freights.
Yeah. That'd be, is that the NP?
Yeah, it was the Northern Pacific. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether they had that up on the highline.
Yeah, I don't know. These guys in Hammer, they'd probably be glad to tell me if that's...
Well, I always, looking back, I always glad, in some ways, that at that period of time, I had to be, grew up in that period of time where I did, I was quite interested in the livestock and riding and all that, and I did have the opportunity to ride the range with some of those old Texas trailers that came in from the state, they were still out
there. Huh?
I can remember 3 of them offhand.
Uh-huh.
I remember one, neighbor kid and I were been out making a big circle looking for some cows, I think it was, and we didn't find them located. We were on the way back to the valley in the afternoon, and we saw 5 riders going the same direction we were, so we just kind of angled over there and fell in. Well, it was neighboring rancher, he was a pretty big operator. M.I. Draper, he had brought a trailer herd into Montana.
Draper?
Yeah, him by a draper. And then I see another old boy there named Taps Eckert. He came with a trail herd, but a lot of those old fellows, they never buried, and they'd have a dugout way out in the hills there someplace where they lived. And he run a lot of horses. That's all he did, was made his living off of horses. And I noticed when we were riding in the valley, he's riding this bronc. He had stirrups hobbled. And a lot of those fellows that couldn't ride weren't real expert riders, you know. They would hobble the stirrups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, at that time, a horse that had to be at least 4 years old before they ever touched it, so they broke it.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can break starting with two.
Mm-hmm.
But then they figured that I got a horse had to be mature because they got in the morning, they might be on it all day or most of the day, and they mm-hmm. had to be standing there.
Yeah.
But anyhow, everything was going along good, and we got down in the valley and on the old road, which is Highway 10 eventually, but that time it was just an old trail. And that horse came unglued with him, old Taps, and boy, he took a beating, but he rode him. And years later, I started thinking about that. I knew the year it was, and I started adding up how old that guy was. And I figured out he was about 75 years old.
Is that right? Up there.
Boy.
On top of a bronc. Huh?
Well, see, that was his only means to eat. They never learned to drive cars,
those
old fellas. And the minute they couldn't get on a horse, they were done.
So he'd ride with hobbled stirrups if he had to.
He'd ride with hobbled stirrups.
What is a hobbled stirrup?
You just run a light rope under the stomach,
like
a cinch, tie the stirrups, see? So when the horse starts booking, he can hurry his tools up, and that helps him stay on. But boy, you could sure just pound the devil out of you, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no give there.
Yeah. Well, these guys came into that country with the big cattle outfits and simply stayed on?
Oh, yeah. A lot of them stayed on. Yeah, and there was another old boy, a neighbor of ours. He was a carrier, old Logan Smith, and he was married, but he never learned to drive a car. And I used to ride out, help him locate cattle. He told me one time he was in Dodge City the night that Matt Masterman had that big battle with some of those guys along the railroad track.
Yeah, I have no idea what year that would have been.
It was in the 80s.
Yeah.
But I laughed one. I was in the summer of 30. Fall of 35, he was a character. And his wife had joined a religious group that didn't believe in smoking or eating pork or anything like that. Of course, old Logan just chewed that old horseshoe tobacco all the time, running down both corners, you know. He caught a ride into town one morning to go to Billing. He was going up and get a winter's supply stuff, you know, that they needed. So Minnie, his wife, asked me if I would take her into town and meet Logan. He'd be in on that bus along about 5 o'clock from Billings. Right, okay. So I had an old Ford truck. When in town met the bus, here was old Logan. He'd had quite a few, and he was feeling pretty good, you know. And he had a slab of bacon and a caddy of chewing tobacco. Minnie was just fit to be tied.
Pretty ready to winter.
Huh? Yeah, Minnie's winter. Two of the things she hated the most. You know.
Jeez. I saw a reference the other day of some sheepherder getting religion like that. Painting on rocks. Repent, the time is nigh. I haven't really thought about that sort of thing going on in this country, but I know it did. So.
My dad came to Montana in the early 1912, yes.
Where'd he come out from?
From Minnesota. Mm. His father died when he was 11, so his mother moved from the farm and into town. My dad started working, driving the dray, delivering groceries for the store, so that was kind of what he fell into, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wanted to come west, and there was a job open out there. Custer, Scott, Harry Scott, had a general store. And at that time, the store handled everything, you know. If you wanted anything, you just came to the store, and if they didn't have, they'd order it for you.
Yeah.
Well, then later on, about 1915, they opened up some of that land north of Custer for homesteading. So Dad said they got quite a community going out there, and then they decided they build a church. So they built a church. Then they decided they would get an organ. They took up enough money to buy an organ, and Dad said they came in and ordered the organ. And then he said it came in, and so they sent a note out on the stage that an organ was there. So he said they sent a couple of their beat men in to haul the organ out. Of course, he said the first thing to do, anybody coming in town, is to hit the saloon and hear it, get the latest news, you know. He said 3 days later, they were sick enough that they just decided they'd better get home, you know.
Uh-huh.
So he helped them load the organ into the wagon, and he saw they had a jug with them. Later that afternoon, here come an old cowboy in from the north country, and he, of course, he hit the saloon too, and he had the darndest tale to tell. He says, you know, I was riding along there, and by golly, I could hear music. And you know, like, gosh, he says, I was hearing things, and I'd stop and listen, and I wouldn't hear it. I'd ride on a little further, and I'd hear it again. By golly, he says, I kept riding and finding the trail went down in this coulee, and by golly, he says, there's an outfit turned over there, and there's an organ, and there was two guys there, and one was a two-finger in that organ, and they had a jug, he says, we're having a hell of a time.
Tipped it over, they might as well make some
music. Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, hell. My dad could tell stories like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd just sit and listen to you. Things, funny things that happen.
Right. Well, how did you two meet? How was in this period?
Well, Bradley was on the lower Madison, and I had my first school teaching job at Central Park.
Oh.
And so I was
so
up
over,
in the same
right over there, although you came out of the same country. Eastern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah,
we didn't meet.
Yeah.
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 Hmm. So I was, some of my family was on the lower Madison, and I was invited out to a country dance. And
I see. Everyone. Somebody was watching for the school mom.
Yeah. Saw that school teacher there.
Yeah.
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 So that's how I met Bradley. No, I didn't know him when we were both in the eastern part of the state.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to have a Fourth of July big shindig in this book of picnic and rodeo and probably square dance at night.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to draw on my memories of going to places like Ringling and so forth. And one thing I think I remember, even in my time, that the desks were all on a set of 2x4s or something, you move all the desks at once. Were you guys ever around any of that? The desks would be bolted into into kind of runners.
Bolted on, yeah.
Yeah, I remember. Move the whole row of desks at once, move them out of the way.
Just move them out of there.
Yeah.
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 This little, of course, most of the country school houses, well, I guess not most of them. When I started teaching, people were still teaching in country schools all over the state. And, you know, the beginning salary was mostly about $60 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And
for several, you handle several grades, I suppose?
Yeah, the first year I taught, I had all grades. I had 8 grades and 18 kids there at Central Park. They sure didn't get much of an education, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
You know, you're trying to teach first graders to read
How did you keep the others busy while you're trying to do something like
well,
that?
Well, I think they sort of keep themselves busy.
Yeah.
They seem to sort of watch the action of whatever is going on. And, of course, I'm sure with more experience and as teachers got better, they had a very good system, you know, and would incorporate a lot of grades into one. It was my first year, so I was still going by the book, you know, trying to have classes in woodworking and sewing, you know, and just impossible.
Yeah.
And I remember I got $7.50 extra a month because I did my own janitor work, which included stoking the furnace. No, they had an automatic furnace, didn't they? They had
a stoker. Yeah. A stoker, but you'd have to fill
it. I had to empty the clinkers out. Yeah, that was quite an educational system. Yeah.
Where'd you live? They have a teacher range?
No, they didn't there at Central Park. I just got my boarding room with the family.
Yeah.
In fact, I think I supported that family all that winter because I remember they never had meat on their table except on weekends. Usually I was gone on weekends. Woman was an excellent cook, and we had a lot of casseroles with cabbage and vegetables and things she had canned. But the husband was out of work all winter, and I think they lived, you know, they bought all their groceries on my $30 a month.
Yeah.
And I don't think it was very easy for them, you know. I had, they had a two-bedroom house, and I had one bedroom, and they had two kids of opposite sexes. Quite know how they managed that.
I've just been rereading Golden Fleece. Was that set down in that country where you guys were? By Huey Call? You know that poem?
She was up Mayennis, wasn't she?
Oh, that's not the one that... Lady of Mayennis.
Tom and Huey Call, I guess, were the couple.
Yeah, I think she was at Mayennis.
I guess that's right. They're
that's pretty country, yeah.
There's a map in the end papers, and they're not far from Virginia City, in fact.
We were up in that country for a while. Bradley moved from down in the lower Madison after we were married, and we spent one summer in Norris on a ranch. And then when he came back from the service, we were at Harris and then at Norris before we moved up here. That's pretty country.
That is. I've only been down there a couple of times, but every time I'm down there, I'm reminded that it is. So. Did you go to a country school?
Yeah, I started out
on the same basis that she was teaching.
I had. I went to two country schools, and then I went to school in Custer, which had, you know, the great high school in the same building, and then Hysham the same way. And I remember when my dad bought this place on the Peace Bottom, there's a school there right at the mouth of Edwards Creek. And we had, our teacher was an old, he had been a cowpuncher, and he had broke his back, a horse had fallen with him, and he was very crippled up, but so he got a little education and became a school teacher.
I'll be darned. I never heard of that kind of transition, transformation.
Well, I'll tell you, we didn't get much of an education either. We never opened a language book for two or three years. And then when I transferred to Hysham, they put a bus on them. Closed that school and put a bus. And I went in eighth grade. Our had English and all of us that had transferred to that school, she finally, we had to outline everything and did all that work. Oh my God.
Making you catch up.
But he didn't like language, but he spelling, he was great on spelling. Then he'd have spelling bees, and then he'd read stories, you know. He had a Saturday Evening Post, and then he'd, Friday afternoon, he'd read those continuous stories. Oh, we loved it. We thought it was great. Well, we sure didn't learn much.
Talk about teaching out of the book. There's a guy who never heard of that.
Oh, boy.
So he'd read you a lot, those old Clarence Buddington, Callahan, cowboy things and so on.
He was a nice fellow, but he... He just didn't...
He really didn't have much background for teaching.
He was down that east around Miles City country. And I know that story is a horse that fought with him.
That's a kind of a curious story. Yeah. That's quite a lot of gumption for him to...
name was Harlan. I can't remember his first name. Yeah, I was by there a few years ago, and the school's all gone. I guess they moved it out of there. Probably named after a guy, that man named Edwards, who the Indians had killed him right about in that area, within 200-300 yards of where the school was.
Oh.
And they buried him there, too. I used to know just where the site was.
When they put on a school bus, was that a fairly sizable bus, or was that more one of these extended coach things that they
Well, it was a regular school bus. Yeah, and I remember my dad, he got the contract that year, first year they had that.
School bus driver?
Yeah. And he, no, they bid, and you had to buy your own bus. It was a contract thing.
Oh, he did?
And he bought that bus. Operated 1 year, and then next year they called for bids by another guy underbid him, so he was stuck with a bus and lost it, and then came, got it, and, you know. So this is how, you know, things weren't too sure in those days, you know.
Yeah, right.
But, I remember once about how people lived in that country. There were a lot of, I'd say, a lot of people lived way out there, away from the valley, and maybe they get in town once a year, you know. And there's one family member, I didn't know them, but my uncle, he told me about them one time. And their names were Shoop. And they made a living running horses. They had old horses. And that's all they did, you know, chase these cayuses and trap them and sell them, you know. Well, they take the whole family to do it, and they had quite a few kids. But when the kids were too young, why, the mother would have to stay home with the little kids. But when they got when they got about 3 years old, then they, they'd have a horse, you know, you want to start running horses with other horses. They get addicted to that, and you know, you don't even have to, just all you got to do is stay there and ride when you're chasing horses, you know? And so what they would do, they'd take these, maybe by the time a kid was 3 years old, they'd put him on a horse and tie him in the saddle, see, then the mother could go too, see, you couldn't lose him because the horse would, boy, that horse would just go like heck with a light kid on it.
He's
a horse.
Right.
But that's how they would do it.
Yeah.
Kid just hang there and rattle all day.
Might lose a kid.
I don't know if they ever lost one. I don't guess they didn't. But my uncle never mentioned anything, ever had any problem with it.
Well, I guess you'd grow up learning how to ride if you survived it, huh?
You got to ride whether you wanted to or not,
Gosh, you're sure a lot of people grew up and survived in ways it's hard to believe anymore.
That is right. I have seen some of the real hard cases out in that country.
Yeah.
Just the kids, you know, I thought, gee, I'm pretty urban here, you know, I know a lot of stuff, you know, I lived right in the heart of civilization. Yeah. Of course, it was pretty Western too, but you go out there 15, 20 miles away from the river, and some of those families, those kids never did get to town. They'd come in and they couldn't figure out how to open one of those doors, those latch-type doors. They'd have to figure that out.
Jeez.
Oh, boy.
Well, these are people who'd homesteaded out there, I guess.
Yeah, just lived out. Then I know we had, when these kids would finally, they maybe have a little school out there. But then when they had, some of them went to high school and some of them didn't. Those that didn't. They were sure green, I know, when they would come into high school.
The kids.
They just never had experienced anything really, you know, living way out there in those hills and breaks.
It's quite a country, all right.
But it sure changed.
Yeah? Is that where the coal is coming out now?
Or we were farther west from there.
Were you?
Yeah.
I don't know that country.
Well, you know where, have you ever heard of Ingomar?
Oh, yeah. I know about where Ingomar is on the map.
We were south of Ingomar towards Yellowstone, right on the Yellowstone.
Oh, yeah.
Yellowstone, not too far to Ingomar. I remember one day our neighbor was a sheep man. He runs sheep all over that country.
Yeah.
West there, and he had his son was about my age, and he wanted to get a hold of another, they were Scotchmen, McConaughey's their name was, and he wanted to get a hold of another Scotchman that runs sheep out of that Ingomar country named Johnny Bell. And he says, I think Johnny is camped on froze to death about now, and his son knew about where the camp would be. So I took our dad's old, I was about 12 years old then, I took our dad's old Model T, and away we went. Cross country, see, no roads or anything, looking for that sheep camp. And we finally found the camp, but Johnny wasn't there. The herder said he had been there, but he was evidently gone back to Ingomar.
Mm-hmm.
So we went on cross country to Ingomar. And those old, most of those old Scotch sheep powder breeders out of Ingomar were bachelors, and they all lived in the hotels, see, there at Ingomar.
Is that right?
And they run their operation from the hotel. And they'd go tend camp.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had a big shearing plant there at Ingomar. And then in the spring of the year, away,
mm-hmm.
they'd bring their herds grassy in, and they'd take turns with their bands shearing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was quite a little town at that time. And 2 years ago, in the joy, when we went down the coal strip there to visit Mike and Kathy, we drove in there. I hadn't been there for over 50 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing left there at all except the school.
Is that right?
And there was that old hotel, and there was still somebody living in it, you know. But the stores, and there were several stores, and a bank, and all that.
Huh. It wasn't.
There's a bar there someplace they call the Jersey Lily. I don't know, I didn't see a sign, but I keep hearing people saying about the Jersey Lily at Ingomar. We didn't see it. They used to spot a tank car of water. Milwaukee would spot a tank car of water there once a week. That's the only water they had
for the town.
Yeah. They'd all pack water from that tank car.
I'll be damned.
Boy, the water, and you couldn't drill far enough, deep enough to get good water.
Uh-huh.
It was bad.
Uh-huh. And there was a number of these old Scotchmen living in the same hotel. Huh?
Yeah, they lived in that. There was a McLeod. There was two McLeod brothers, I remember, and Johnny Bell, and the Rapsteads. And now I don't know whether they were Scotch or not, but they were sheep on.
Uh-huh. Well, think of the stories that must have gone on in that hotel.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Those guys, huh? Somebody tells me that there's still a sheep outfit in Ingomar. I don't know whose it is. But I called the Montana wool growers once here, asking, you know, where are there any sheep? I can't seem to see any anymore. And they said Sebans and a place in Ingomar and one or two others.
I was talking to a soil conservation man down here, and he starts telling a story about he'd been on this big sheep outfit down in Ingomar, and it's some corporation now, and I can't remember the name of it. Mm-hmm. He says they operate under, he said he was in that one pasture, and I forget how many square miles he said was in that pasture. Oh, like 30 or 40 square miles.
That's the way I hear it now.
All under a fence. See?
Yeah.
I don't know what good that does. I mean,
yeah.
Sheep, the coyotes out.
Sheep will find a way to kill themselves, whether they're on fence or not. Coyotes will find.
But
a way
he
to
said them. It was a pretty well managed operation. He says it was really good managed.
Yeah,
quite successful.
You say he told me that a big Mexican shearing crew still comes in there to, I guess, handle this outfit too. So,
but I can't think of the name of that outfit.
Well, the whole town of Ingomar would run on this tank car of water.
Yeah. Now, maybe that wouldn't be enough, or we maybe had to have more tanks, but I know they always spotted the tanks of water there.
Mm-hmm.
Then I remember when we lived on the road from Billings, as a Highway 10 then at that time, but it was unimproved. It was just a trail, you know, not graveled or anything. And this one fellow had hauled gas from Billings. They had a refiner in Billings, and he had just a little old ton truck in those days, I suppose about a 10-foot box, and he'd had 50-gallon drums, all he could get in that box, And he'd go to the refinery and fill up in gas and haul it to Ingmar, and that would, they had that service station there. That's supply Ingmar with gas.
The place is kind of a space station of its time, isn't it?
Yeah, that was before they had any, well, there wasn't any facilities to store any great amount of gas.
Yeah.
Now, later years, I probably didn't have Ingmar, but all these towns, they'd pull in with a tank car, you know, and unload.
Yeah, right.
Both plants, but they didn't have those things. Those
mm-hmm.
days, you know, they were just, yeah, I remember my dad saying when he came, well, there were five, I still got the picture of them. I got lined them up. I think there was five automobiles in that whole area, Custer area.
Is that right?
At that time, yeah.
Lined them up for a group photo.
In front of the saloon, you know. And they'd get that gas in a barrel, and they want gas, why, they just had a can and a funnel with a screen in it, and they just had a spigot on the barrel, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and just, you know, bring it out in a, I don't know how large a can they had,
mm-hmm.
that's how they'd fill it, those
yeah.
cars.
That's kind of what we did on the reservation for our Jeep in the late 50s. We'd go into Browning and fill a 50-gallon drum, and then you'd spill as much gas trying
yeah.
to fill any kind of a can as you'd,
yeah.
as you'd get to use. But that was pretty much the deal up there, too. So, yeah. Huh. Well, Ingmar sounds like a real metropolis.
Yeah, that was quite a little city at that time.
Yeah.
But it's sure nothing there. And then they still have them on the map, like Bonanda.
Yeah, right.
Bonanda, and then there's another one west of Ingmar. What the world? I can't. Sumatra.
Uh huh.
There's nothing there, and there's nothing at Bonanda except there's an old brick building that boarded up, but they still have them on the map. I don't know why they have them on the map.
Well, I've heard of Sumatra.
And there's nothing there.
There's nothing exists. I figured.